Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, the nation's highest court convened for a new term, its first full year with Justice Neil Gorsuch on board, and a full bench after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. On the docket, gay rights versus religious freedom, cell phone privacy, gerrymandering, and voter rights, maybe the president's travel ban. This hour on Point, the Supreme Court's new term and direction. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The most important sound in advance of this term may have come last April with the swearing in of Donald Trump's man now on the bench, Neil Gorsuch, on the White House lawn. The president who nominated him looking on as he's sworn in here by Supreme Court Justice Kennedy.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And Neil Gorsuch comes onto the bench. His first full term right in front of us. What kind of term will it be? Here was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg talking to first-year law students, including the president's daughter, Tiffany Trump, at Georgetown Law Center last week. She concluded her prepared remarks with this prediction about the upcoming term.
There's only one prediction that's entirely safe about the upcoming term, and that is it will be momentous.
Momentous. Okay, we're all ears. Joining me now from Washington is Joan Biskupic, legal analyst for CNN, former Supreme Court reporter for USA Today and The Washington Post. She's written biographies of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, Sandra Day O'Connor, Sonia Sotomayor. She's currently working on a biography of Chief Justice John Roberts. Joan Biskupic, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, David Savage joins us, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he has been on this beat a good long time. He's covered every confirmation hearing for all the current justices. David, great to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Joan, when the Justice Ginsburg says momentous term coming up, is it clear to you what she's talking about?
It is, and I think she's exactly right. Plus, she knows something we don't know. Just from the outside, we know that they finally have nine and that they're not going to steer away from 4-4 deadlock, so they'll jump right in and probably decide things more broadly than they did when they only had the eight and feared deadlocks. Mm-hmm. We know that they have more contentious cases before them. But what Justice Ginsburg brings to this that David and I and you don't know is she knows what's been going on behind the scenes. And she knows what went on in the conference room since last April when Neil Gorsuch came on. So even from the outside, we can see new dynamics among these nine, but she knows firsthand what they've been saying across the table to each other. And she's probably predicting a couple of bombshells from the conservative majority, or at least some fights.
David, explain those dynamics, the behind-the-scenes dynamics, and how they lie behind, underlie what ultimately comes out from the court.
Well, Tom, to some degree, we don't know, but I think that Ruth Ginsburg saw enough of Neil Gorsuch during the 7 weeks to know that he's inclined to push the law to the right. Take one example. A year ago, I thought, most people thought, the whole issue of same-sex marriage was settled, that the Supreme Court had ruled that's a constitutional right, and gay couples are entitled to equal rights. Well, there was a case at the end of the term where a lesbian couple from Arkansas wanted to have both of their names on a birth certificate. Mm-hmm. The Arkansas Supreme Court said, no, no, you can't do that. The Supreme Court took the case and issued a summary reversal. That is, they said, we're not even going to bother to hear this. It's clear that this couple is entitled to equal rights, both names on the birth certificate. Gorsuch wrote a fairly strong dissent. And I think Ruth Ginsburg and others may be thinking, well, there's some of the conservatives are willing and interested in refighting some of the battles over gay rights and surely abortion, because Republican states are going to continue to push the margin on new restrictions on abortion. And Gorsuch and the conservatives are, you know, apparently willing to, you know, reopen that issue.
Can we just stick with that for a second? Did you read his dissent on having both of these women's names on the birth certificate? Was it an argument against what we thought was now subtle law endorsing gay marriage, or something more nuanced?
A little bit of both, Tom. It wasn't saying we need to go back and overturn the Obergefell decision.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, in effect, there's a series of questions that are unanswered here. And some of the questions about equal rights for gay couples, about things like adoption and birth certificates, he seemed to think were still open for debate. And as I say, the other justices didn't agree with him, but Gorsuch seemed like he was inclined to sort of relitigate at least part of that issue.
Joan, we'll dive into the details, but do you see a court which could have fundamentally different chemistry with Neil Gorsuch on it now and turn even what we thought were settled issues into live issues again here?
Most definitely. He already has aligned with the most far-right justices, Clarence Thomas, on the most mm-hmm. conservative jurist we have, and then also with Samuel Alito. He's not aligning himself as much with middle conservative Anthony Kennedy or Chief Justice John Roberts. Again, on the hottest issues, he's shown that he wants to be almost a real throwback conservative, wanting to relitigate gun control also, even though this court has already gone further on the Second Amendment. He wants it to perhaps loosen restrictions on firearms that still exist. He signaled in many ways, and I think what that will do, first of all, it will embolden Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito to an extent. And I think the thing to watch is whether he pushes someone like the chief a little bit more to the left, because we've seen in the past when justices come on pretty strong, they can actually have a bit of an alienating effect. Justice Antonin Scalia did that famously with Sandra Day O'Connor mm-hmm. in the 90s. So it's not just that he's going to be a force pulling these nine individuals more rightward. He could have some other repercussions that could potentially backfire, frankly.
Sandra Day O'Connor turned to more somewhat more progressive rulings, perhaps, in response,
correct.
Reaction to
correct.
Antonin Scalia in his day. A lot we're going to dive into here, but we've got gay rights already on the table, and there's a case, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, that goes right to this. It's the old debate about whether the wedding cake baker, required under the law to make a cake for a gay couple. Here's a baker named Jack Phillips, refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple on religious grounds. He talked in August of 2015 to Fox Business.
My case is the government is trying to force me to violate my personal religious freedom and, you know, create a cake for a ceremony that I have objections to.
Create cake for a ceremony that I have objections to. David, can you tell us about this case, Masterpiece Cake?
Well, sure. It is one of these cases that begins with real people. I mean, young guys who were about to get married in Massachusetts and wanted to come back to Colorado and have a wedding celebration
mm-hmm.
there
yep.
in 2012, walked into his bake shop. It had been recommended by their reception planner.
Mm-hmm.
And
had
a very short conversation. He said, they said they were interested in a wedding cake. And he said, is it for you guys? And they said, yes. And he said, well, sorry, guys, I don't make cakes for same-sex couples. And he has Mr. Phillips has this view that he says, I'm willing to serve anybody who comes into the store, but if I make a wedding cake for them, I'm violating my conscience because the Bible says a marriage is between a man and a woman. They went to Colorado, like 20 other states, has a law that says if you're in business and serving the public, you may not deny to any customer the full and equal service that all customers get based on sexual orientation. And the Colorado Commission and the Colorado courts basically said Mr. Phillips violated mm-hmm. the law. And he's appealed in the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that I have a First Amendment right, first of freedom of speech, and second, free exercise of religion, not to participate in sending a message or creating a message that violates my conscience.
And what do you see coming from this court?
Well, I think it's a close call. On the one hand, Justice Kennedy has been the strongest voice in striking down the laws that discriminate against gays and lesbians. So you'd think Kennedy is never going to go back on that. However, he also has a great fondness for these free speech claims, and there were cases in the 90s, for example. There was a case from Boston about the parade, the annual parade, and that sponsored by the war vets, and a group of Irish gays and lesbians wanted to parade, and mm-hmm. the Massachusetts court said, yes, you have that right, and the Supreme Court said, no, you don't, because the parade sponsors shouldn't have to alter their message to, in effect, endorse gay rights. Kennedy was on that opinion. So I think I'm interested in Jones' take on this. I think it's a close call. Kennedy is, on the one hand, a strong believer in gay rights, but he's also a strong believer in free speech claims.
It's a big deal. Joan, what do you see coming as far as you can make out?
Yeah, no, I think this one is tough because Justice Kennedy has embraced his role as the voice of gay rights in America. Since 1996, he has written the majority opinions giving gays more rights, including a constitutional right to marriage 2 years ago. So he has that. But the argument from this cake maker is pretty compelling. He says, I have an expressive service here, and I'm being asked to violate my religious belief. The question, though, for anybody who would side with this baker is, what about other wedding services? The florists, the DJs, the reception rooms, you know, where do you draw the line?
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the big agenda for the Supreme Court's new term. Starts Monday, looking at gerrymandering, religious liberty versus gay rights, privacy and your cell phone, maybe President Trump's travel ban, and more. David Savage is with us with the Los Angeles Times. Joan Biskupic is here, Supreme Court biographer, legal analyst for CNN. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you tuned in to what is on the court's docket in this new term, to the political bent of the court, with Neil Gorsuch now on the bench? All the seats filled, no more 4-4 ties, we're working to avoid them. Do you want the court to stand with the baker at Masterpiece Cake Shop or with the gay couple who wanted his cake? Do you want the court to say no to highly partisan political redistricting? And what about it? Should police need a warrant to track you everywhere on your cell phone? We've got some interesting cases here. David, Joan, people responding online about this Masterpiece Cake question. Listener at the website says, if you can't deny selling a cake to a black person, you shouldn't be able to deny selling one to a gay person. And they go on. They say, if you're using your religion as justification for the latter, it might be time to consider a less hateful religion. On the other hand, here's Grant, who writes into us on Facebook, says, honestly, just find another cake maker, people. Somebody else will get the honor of taking your money. Joan, how do you expect this one to be argued?
Both of those points will be front and center before the nine justices when it is argued, because your first caller who wrote in, mm-hmm. recalls the civil rights public accommodations fights.
Yep.
When retailers and service providers
the
said,
lunch
I don't
counter
want to serve.
And all that.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's what the challenges are saying here. And that's what the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that ruled in favor of these gay men said was that if you're going to serve, if you're going to have a policy of serving anyone a wedding cake, you have to serve this gay couple or else you're violating their rights. But it goes, as your second caller brings in the idea of what about that service provider's religious liberty and free speech claims. I think it will be tough, and I think we'll start to see, we'll know when it's argued some clues from the bench. But I should also mention, Tom, this is one of the cases that the justices haven't scheduled yet for oral arguments. So the soonest we'll see these clues would be late November, December. But this one I could see not being decided until June, the crunch month next year.
People would be watching that for a long time. David, think for a minute with us about the implications. It's not just cake. I mean, if they should decide for the baker, what other kinds of rights or services might gay couples see endangered? Their access.
Well, it's a good question, Tom, because a lot of times with the Supreme Court decisions, it's not only just sort of who wins, but how broad or how narrow the decision is. The Trump administration joined the case on the side of the baker, and they argued for what they called a narrow exception. That is, for certain people, a musician, a painter, perhaps a florist, somebody whose business is expressive. On the other hand, if you run a hotel or a restaurant, they said you can't deny, you know, space, and you can't deny having a reception in your hotel or your restaurant because you don't want to, because you don't approve of same-sex marriages. If you run a limousine service, you can't deny, you know, limousines because. So they were trying to say, and the religious rights groups have tried to make the same argument. Oh, we're only asking for a very narrow exception for people whose work is expressive, like the photographer, like the florist. So we'll have to see. And I guess I don't know how that will play out in the real world. I've heard people say, well, you know, medical advice can be considered expressive, or legal advice can be, you can describe a lot of things as expressive if you're so inclined.
Kathy in Dover, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Kathy. You're on the air. Hi, Kathy. Are you there? Looks like we lost Kathy. Let's go to Morgan in Columbia, South Carolina. Morgan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. My thoughts are, why get the government involved and force people like a cake maker or a florist or whomever to do those things? Let the free market decide. For whoever doesn't want to make a cake, someone will.
Well, but Morgan, what if somebody said, I don't want to rent rooms to Southerners? Would you like the free market to be...
That's a totally different thing based on a religious preference.
Free market decide. Joan, what do you say?
Well, what the Colorado Civil Rights Commission believes is that certain groups need protection, and you know, based on race, based on sex, and in Colorado, based on sexual orientation. So it has a rule that a proprietor can't say, I'm not going to provide services to someone based on sexual orientation. In this case, the baker had just sat down with these two men, and he didn't even want to go further than once he heard that it was going to be to celebrate their union, he stopped everything and said, I don't want to do this because I don't do it for gay individuals. And that's what the Colorado law is trying to protect people from.
But how do past cases go to this just a simple question? You know, Morgan says, let the market sort it out. So, okay, he won't, but somebody else will. And if they want the money, they'll come get it. I mean, our courts have gone well beyond that for a long time.
Oh, certainly for many protected classes. It's the question of how should these people be protected? Should they be protected the way somebody would be based on race, based on sex? Certainly, the Supreme Court has never gone there and Congress has never gone there. But since Colorado has a state law that seeks to protect people based on sexual orientation, that's an issue. Now, one thing I should say, many, many states have other laws that are sometimes in tension with these kinds of civil rights laws that protect people based on their religious liberty, religious rights. Mm-hmm. And they're called mini religious Restoration Freedom Act laws. And if Colorado had one of those laws, as I said, some other states do, here, Jack Phillips, the baker, might have been able to invoke that too, because those laws are intended to specifically protect someone based on their religious interests in this kind of marketplace. So there are a lot of conflicting interests here. As David pointed out, the baker here is claiming two First Amendment rights, free speech and free exercise, whereas the state Civil Rights Commission and this gay couple are talking about their right to be treated equally based on their sexual orientation.
And Justice Anthony Kennedy, likely the deciding vote here with interest in all of these issues, gay rights, but also First Amendment and the freedom of religion issues here. I want to turn to gerrymandering, political redistricting. You've got this case of Gill versus Whitford, state of Wisconsin, appealing a lower court ruling that it had redrawn voting districts to favor Republicans. Here's a little bit from reporter Jessica Gomez on Hearst Television's Matter of Fact with Soledad O'Brien. She's interviewing Helen Harris, a Democratic voter and one of the people who sued the state.
It makes you feel that your concerns and the issues that you care about are not being represented.
Harris is now a plaintiff in the case about to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. If upheld, state and congressional districts nationwide could be challenged, potentially shifting the balance of power for both parties.
David Savage, take us into this case. Wisconsin redistricting, this has been an issue all over the country, but this is the case that's before the court. What is it, and what does it frame up?
Well, the Wisconsin case is about the map drawn for the state assembly. The Republicans took full control in Wisconsin in 2010. They drew a map for the state assembly that was essentially guaranteed to make sure that they would have a 60-vote supermajority, 60 of 99 seats, no matter how the votes went. And it worked as planned. In 2012, a year later, the Democrats, 51% of Wisconsin's voters voted for Democrats,
okay,
but the Republicans maintained a 60-vote majority in the state legislature.
Because of the way those districts were very deliberately drawn.
Exactly right. The deal is, Tom, you and I were heading opposite parties and I can draw the district lines. I could draw the district lines so my people win like a 55-45 majority in three or four districts, and then I'll give you one. You'll have 80% of your party,
right,
and 20%. And so you can take, using computer software and good data, you can take a state that is evenly balanced and give your party a supermajority, and you can do it for a decade. You're entrenched for a decade, as the lower court said.
Because these are redrawn every 10 years.
Yes. And then guess who gets to decide on it 10 years hence? The same party in power. So the court is being asked to say this has gone too far. You're essentially, to use a Donald Trump term, you have rigged the election. You have rigged the election so that no matter which way state voters tilt, the party that drew the lines is going to hold the power. Let me mention, somebody mentioned the congressional districts in that. I think it's very interesting what this could mean for the House of Representatives.
Okay.
And here's my favorite simple example. Take the state of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan,
mm-hmm,
three Rust Belt states that have gone back and forth. They're classic battleground states. Barack Obama won twice there. Trump won last year. They have 48 seats in the House of Representatives. The Constitution assumes the House of Representatives will be the body that's representative of the people. Do you know what the breakdown is?
No.
There are 34 Republicans and 14 Democrats from those three states.
Because?
Because the lines were drawn. In each case, in 2010, the Republicans were in control in the state capitol. They drew the districts so that their candidates are going to win. Pennsylvania is 13-5. Ohio is 12-4. Michigan is 9-5. Another battleground state, North Carolina, 10-3. And so, the Brennan Center has looked at this and said that the gerrymandering has given the Republicans in the House a net of something like 17 seats. And it would take, in 2018, about a 24-seat flip to flip the control of the House of Representatives.
So it's right at the heart of who's got the majority.
Correct.
Joan, has the Supreme Court ever come in and struck down an election map on the grounds that it was too partisan?
Never. In fact, it's struck down maps because of racial gerrymandering, but never partisan gerrymandering. And what they're presented with here are arguments from challengers who say, now is the time to go further, to say that the kinds of processes we're witnessing across the country, because of the high-tech ability to use voter data and to draw lines with precision that, as the challengers call it, cracking and packing. That's dividing up party supporters among multiple districts, but then packing other party voters into mm-hmm. another district. So you completely dilute the votes on the other side. Mm-hmm. And what the challengers say is, Supreme Court, you should be able to weigh in here because we've got a standard. And the district court that heard this case and ruled in November of 2016, who said this so clearly constitutes an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander, said that you could test whether the party in control systematically diluted the other side's votes. And they talk about something called the efficiency gap, which would be the difference between the party's respective wasted votes in the election divided by the total votes cast. And if one side's votes are just so inefficiently used, mm-hmm. you know that the party in control really tried to screw them, so to speak. That mm-hmm. is not a legal term. But to get to your question about whether the court will even decide this, the justices themselves have said a threshold question for this, when it is argued, and it's going to be argued next week, the second day of the term, will be, should we even come into this? A 1986 case said that they could, but they've never found one, Tom. They've never found a gerrymander to be unconstitutional. And in 2004, they even cast doubt on whether one would ever be found. Wow. And again, no surprise, it comes down to Justice Kennedy, who in his writing in the 2004 case did not rule out that a district would be unconstitutionally gerrymandered. So this is a very hard case for the challengers. But what they speak to is democracy, integrity in voting, and those are things that are very important for Justice Kennedy.
High political stakes. Let's go to Nate in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. Nate, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. And as someone from Wisconsin, I am definitely paying attention to Whitford versus Gill.
Mm-hmm.
I think if the appeals court verdict is upheld, we'll actually have democracy restored in our state legislature. And I have to thank the bipartisan group, which includes some Republicans, who really do have the integrity to say elections should be honest. And, I mean, John McCain and Governor Kasich even joined in to say this is not how a democracy works. We should have freedom and democracy at home.
Nate, we've got it. Watching very closely there from the state where this case is rooted, Wisconsin. Appreciate your call. We've got plenty of comments on Facebook about this. Kathleen says, extreme gerrymandering in Wisconsin. She writes to us, the only reason Paul Ryan still has his seat is because his district is drawn down to the individual households in order to pack and crack his district. This is how Republicans hold on to state houses and congressional districts. Kathleen says, by cheating, the Supreme Court will have its own view on that. Lisa writes to us, gerrymandering is a huge issue. It goes beyond the normal. I want my vote to count for something in Wisconsin. David, how do you see this being argued and maybe being decided?
Well, as Joan said, it all depends on Justice Kennedy, as a sort of familiar refrain. But in the 2004 case, he wrote an opinion that said he was troubled by gerrymandering, and he thought it was a type of First Amendment violation because the notion of the First Amendment is you have political views, you cast a ballot, and to some degree, your views have some effect. And if the majority party can write the rules so that your votes don't count for a decade, something about that seems wrong. Kennedy always said this sounds wrong. It sounds unconstitutional, but we need a clear rule. And so the question is whether Justice Kennedy is going to say, having looked at this for another decade, this is a malfunctioning in our democracy. It's unrepresentative. The state legislatures are not representative of the people's votes. The majority vote can't change the legislature. Something is wrong with that. And we ought to write an opinion that says if you draw districts for partisan reasons and it has a partisan effect and it entrenches the majority in power for a decade, that's unconstitutional.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big agenda for the Supreme Court's new term starts Monday. Gerrymandering, religious liberty versus gay rights, privacy and your cell phone, maybe President Trump's travel ban. David Savage is with us. Joan Biskupic is with us. You are welcome to join us. The president, certainly, on the campaign trail, talked a lot about this court. Here he was from ABC News.
Supreme Court justices. That's all. That's all you have to think. That's all you have to think.
I'm going to appoint justices of the United States Supreme Court who will follow the Constitution.
Okay. Who's going to be on that court? Well, Neil Gorsuch is on it now. We all saw what happened there after Antonin Scalia met his untimely demise. And now everybody looking at this court, its political tendency, its philosophical tendencies, Neil Gorsuch on there, and the ages of people on this court. You can join us in this hour. We're looking at gerrymandering and all the rest. What do you see in these cases, and what do you see in this court? Its instincts, its balance, its ages. Breyer, 79. Kennedy, 81. Ginsburg, 84. Gorsuch, 50. People watching Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's 84, went through a tough bout of cancer back in the 90s. But since then, she's been doing a twice-weekly workout in the justices-only gym with a former Special Forces reservist named Bryant Johnson. She's called him the most important person in her life. And here she was last week at Georgetown Law Center telling students that real justices do real push-ups. She feels great, she said.
I can be exhausted at the end of the day when I meet Brian and spend an hour with him. I come back feeling fresh.
So I understand that you can do 20 push-ups and that you don't use your knees.
No. We started by just standing up, pushing against a door. Then we did the knee thing. And now, for many years, we have been doing regular push-ups.
Very good.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right there, 84, and her fitness an issue when it comes to the future of this country and decisions of the Supreme Court. We've got a lot to dive into here yet. We've been looking at gerrymandering, been looking at religious liberty and gay rights. There's a case also on cell phones and privacy, Joan. Tell us about that one, if you would.
Yes, this is a case that almost all your listeners will be concerned about, because who doesn't have a cell phone these days, and who isn't carrying that cell phone when he or she is going about business? And the question is whether police need a warrant to get your historical cell phone records, revealing where you were, your location, and your movements over the course of several days, whether that's permitted without a warrant under the Fourth Amendment. And this case began when two men were convicted of several armed robberies for a string of robberies at Radio Shacks and T-Mobile stores in and around Detroit. And the police were able to FBI were able to track these individuals by their cell phone numbers and the locations of the robberies, and were able to get the records from their wireless carrier, so they could say, you know, you, Timothy Carpenter, he's the lead defendant here, that's where you were. So it's a very important case about privacy rights in this modern era where everybody is working with a cell phone. And what the government says is, look, these are the kinds of records that are they don't really give that much information about an individual. They don't require a search warrant. They're almost like in the olden days what were called pen registers, where they could search your old rotary phones to figure out what numbers you were dialing. But the challengers are saying, in this day and age, what we've got on on our cell phones tells so much more about us, that it's much more information, and it could be used against us, as it obviously was against this Timothy Carpenter and Timothy Sanders, that it's the kind of thing that you do indeed need a warrant for. Now, back in 2012 and 2014, the justices actually bit off some cases involving digital devices. In 2012, mm-hmm. they held that a GPS device attached to a vehicle to monitor the vehicle's movements did constitute a search under the Fourth Amendment. They splintered in their rationale, which, Tom, that's a tip-off that in some of these cases it might be hard for them to get majority reasoning. But then in 2014, they also again, you know, valued the idea of cell phone and right to privacy in a way that they hadn't before. So I think both of those prior cases could inform what goes on here.
Does it matter? I mean, it matters, but you've got majority reasoning, like a consistent line of reasoning about a case, and then there's just a majority vote. You could have a majority vote without majority reasoning, right?
Oh, definitely. And that's when it gets tougher. We saw that on the old culture wars issues like abortion and even death penalty issues. But here with these modern tech ones, you'll definitely see that. For example, in this case I first referred to about the attaching of the GPS, they were unanimous in part of it, but splintered in their reasoning. And the same thing was true actually, down the road in the 2014 Riley case.
What did the lower court say in this cell phone case, David?
The lower court upheld the search and basically they said it was okay to use this information. As Joan said, there's an interesting line of cases that goes back 50 or 60 years ago, and the court has to sort of revisit it in this age when, you know, the big issue here is there's an enormous amount of data that can be gathered. And the question is it going to be hard or easy for police and investigators to get it? And to go back to the 60s, they said in the wiretapping situation, if the government is going to tap a phone and listen to your phone conversations, you have a right to privacy in your own phone conversations. And if the government's going to do that, they need to get a warrant. But about 10 years later, they said in matter like bank records and phone records, that's not really private. In other words, if you write a lot of checks in the old days, you send it off, you're sending that off to a bank and somebody else's. Mm-hmm. The government could get that with just a sort of a subpoena and get the records because they said that's not really private. So the question now is, are the data from cell towers, is that truly private and therefore police need a warrant, or is it like the old thing of it's just records? The current law says that if I'm an investigator and I have specific facts that these records would be relevant to an ongoing investigation, I can get them without a warrant. And there's a lot of privacy advocates on the right and left urging the court to say warrants are the rule. But I think there's going to be a very strong argument on the other side because investigators need this. Imagine, unfortunately, in Boston, for example, yep. Suppose a bomb goes off on Monday. Mm. A week later, another bomb goes off in another part of the city, and then a third bomb the week later. The FBI and investigators are desperate to try to find who might be behind this. And there are cell phone tower records. They may be able to get records and run and try to make a connection to say,
so why not get a warrant? What's the problem with getting a warrant? Is that clear?
Because they wouldn't be able to, Tom. They don't know who. To get a warrant, you have to have probable cause to believe Joe Smith has committed a crime. Well, you don't know who the Joe Smith is.
Oh, you mean
is.
They want to run it the other way? Just go to the cell phone company computers and say, who's been in these locations?
That's right. They want to get the record. They don't know who the suspect is.
Mm-hmm.
They might be monitoring 1,000 people that they think are potential terrorists in the greater Boston area, the greater New York area. Yeah. They don't know who the suspect is. They want the records to try to find the suspect, and you can't get a search warrant if you don't know who you think has committed the crime. So that's why the records, the data is really important.
Where are the most important opinions on the bench then in this case, Joan? Who?
Oh, well, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the case in 2014. But before that, in 2012, actually, I believe it was Scalia. I'm trying to remember. What do you think, David? Was it Scalia back in Jones?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, we know he won't be writing it, but it will be.
And how did he come down? He was on which side of this?
Well, what they did, that one was the one where they said attaching a GPS device does constitute a search. But that was where they also splintered. I think there were like five different opinions in that one. So they were.
May I interrupt on that, Joan?
Yeah.
Justice Scalia had this sort of old-fashioned view that the Fourth Amendment protected your places. In other words, there was a case about if you bring a police dog up to your front porch to sniff for drugs, Justice Scalia thought that was a search. He didn't like this right to privacy idea because it was too vague. And in this case, the GPS case, the police went up and snuck up to a car and attached a GPS device. Justice Scalia said that's a search because they attached it. So he wasn't interested in the big question about can you be tracked in public. It's that he thought they violated the search, by attaching it to your car. So he had a different view. He's now gone. And they're now going to focus, I think, on this bigger question about if all this data is out there, doesn't it sort of invade your privacy if the government can sort of draw a map wherever you and say where you've been everywhere for the last month?
And here's one other thing I would add to that. Even though Justice Scalia had laid down those markers in terms of the fact that it could constitute a search, the next question is, was the search reasonable? So it's kind of a two-parter in some of these, and that's what splintered the justices back in 2012 in that GPS case. But, you know, Tom, one other element here is what are our expectations of privacy? The police over the years have said if you turn over information to a third party, like your phone company, how you're dialing numbers, or in this case, obviously, to your wireless carrier, that you might have a lower expectation of privacy. But what the challengers and their backers are saying is, of course, we're going to be turning over lots of private information to our wireless companies these days because that's how it works. But don't think that that has diminished our expectations of what's private. And so they've got very large questions to resolve when it comes down to these Radio Shack robberies.
You can't get much more private or personal anyway these days than cell phones. Jesse in St. Petersburg, Florida. Jesse, thank you for calling. You're on.
How you doing, Tom?
Well, what do you think, Jesse?
The police have various methods of tracking cell phones. They have scanners they can keep in the trunk that mimic cell phone towers. They have planes that watch you with cameras. Does this decision cover only the records that come out of telephone companies and other, ISPs, or does it include any information about your cell phone that police can gather in any way they deem necessary?
David, Joan, do you know?
I think the answer is sort of a little of both. In other words, they're only going to rule on cell phone data towers. So it could be narrow. But a lot of lawyers think that once the Supreme Court starts announcing Fourth Amendment rules for data and cell phone, that it will inevitably leak over and be applied to other cases. So we'll have to see how they write an opinion in this case. But it certainly will be about cell phone towers, and it may go beyond that.
Could we talk for a minute about the travel ban? I mean, until very recently, I think you had Trump versus Hawaii scheduled for October 10th, where they would look at the president's travel ban. And now, of course, the administration has come out with the new rules on travel, more countries in there, not just Muslim countries. And I guess the court has, Joan, hit the brakes on this for the time being? Where does it stand?
It did, and it makes sense because the case that was to be argued on October 10th involved, first of all, a different policy, and it involved rulings about that policy and rationale.
And this is the original ban that came
exactly.
out shortly after Donald
it's
Trump took
March
office,
one.
And everybody went crazy.
Right. Actually, the most original one was scrapped. Mm. That was the January 27th
right.
one that caused so much trouble at the airports. And then the administration came back in early March with an amended one. And now we're on the third one. And what the Supreme Court did shortly after the third one was announced was not only say, stop, we're taking this off of our calendar for now. And we're going to, they're required a more briefing from the parties. But I actually think that makes sense because the Supreme Court, when it reviews any kind of disputed policy looks to see what lower courts have said. And in the case that had been on the calendar, they were dealing with, for example, a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that rested on Donald Trump's statements about the
Muslims on the campaign trail.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was specifically looking at that March executive order and his statements in that context. So I think the justices rightly feel like they need more information. But this isn't going away. In fact, since Donald Trump's not going away, Donald Trump's bold policies are not going away. I think we're gonna have. If it's not a dispute on the travel ban, we could have a dispute on the sanctuary cities. We will see Donald Trump and his policies up at the Supreme Court many times in upcoming months.
Donald Trump not going away. What about the Mueller investigation, David? Could the high court get pulled into that if the special counsel, Robert Mueller, begins to take legal measures against the president or his intimates?
Well, I guess the answer is certainly yes, but I can't see right now what the issue is going to be. But in other words, if Mueller goes to indict somebody or there's some dispute about whether—
What if the president fires him?
Well, I'm not sure how you make a legal issue out of that. That seems to me a constitutional question that would go—essentially, the question would be, isn't it an impeachable offense to obstruct justice— by getting rid of the designated investigator who's investigating your campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how you could get that into the federal courts and the Supreme Court. I do think it's a big legal constitutional issue for the House of Representatives.
Well, the whole country watching that, and I don't know exactly how it would get there, but somehow I can imagine that ending up there one day. We've got a lot on the docket before that, sitting right in front of us, and you two have been great in helping us work through it. I really want to thank you. David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. David, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Joan Biskupic, legal analyst for CNN, currently working on a biography of Chief Justice John Roberts. We will look for that. Joan, thank you, as always, for being with us. Really great.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.